I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Scaffold is supported by the Architecture Foundation, bringing new voices to the conversation about architecture in London and around the world. For more information and upcoming events, visit architecturefoundation.org.uk. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and you're listening to Scaffold. In this episode, I speak with Takeshi Hayatsu, director of the London-based practice Hayatsu Architects. Takeshi was born in Japan and moved from Tokyo to London in 1993 to study at the Architectural Association, before working for practices including David Chipperfield, Haworth Tompkins, and 6A Architects, where he worked for 11 years before setting up his own practice in 2016. Takeshi and I recorded our conversation over Zoom in February of 2022, where I reached him at his studio in Bermondsey. And we talked about, among other things, the influence of Japan's so-called Red School architects on Hayatsu's own approach to design, and his interest in symbolism and animism in architecture as human gestures that can pay respect to nature. We also discussed the process of co-designing architecture, and how Hayatsu enables meaningful participation with the communities he's designing for without losing his own sensibility or identity as a designer. And now, here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it.
I was drawn to Archigram and kind of a high-tech kind of architecture.
Really?
Yes. No, I was so kind of inspired by their work when I was in Tokyo, when I was studying bachelor at kind of degree course. I was a big fan of future systems. So that's why I came to the UK originally. I mean, the Archigram was long gone. I mean, I realized that, you know, when I went there. And then, Peter Salter and Peter Beardsley was teaching materials and geologies, landscape, that sort of more kind of tangible material-based teaching.
Interesting. So it sounds like there's this dichotomy or this balance between the ideas that Archigram were espousing around relationships between architecture and media and the speculative value of hypothetical architectural projects that reimagine the cities we live in. And then on the other hand, people like Peter Salter, who are so engaged with sensation and the haptic, the way we touch and feel and kind of engage with space. So tell me more about what was going on, I guess, in your head as a student, as you were sitting between these two poles.
It was a really struggle. I mean, mostly to do with my kind of limited ability to speak and listen the English language, but also the work I was hoping to carry on from the degree work, somehow it was not quite right. I mean, my fourth year work was basically sort of a collaging jellyfish with a kind of baby and, I don't know, floating in the world, that kind of stuff.
That sounds totally surreal.
I wanted to. Well, my degree work is called jellyfish architecture. So there's no straight lines, everything kind of curvy and sort of floating in the water, that sort of stuff.
This is what you were producing at the AA?
No, I was producing.
This is still Tokyo?
Yeah, it was Tokyo and then carried on at the AA. Mm. But I came to sort of the wall that I can't continue.
I mean, I don't want to spend too much time dwelling on the weird early stages of your ideas about architecture as a student, but this is really intriguing to me. Could you talk more about the obstacles you faced and the transition you made away from this highly speculative, what sounds like biophilic kind of work, into something which I imagine is more pragmatic.
Yes, so I felt I needed something more kind of tangible, not just a sort of ideas or concept. Peter's unit was the only one who was dealing with light and shadows, weathering, and decay, all this sort of fascinating stuff. But, you know, I had no idea. And that, you know, failed my diploma work afterwards. I couldn't finish. Peter said, yeah, and you need to repeat a year. So, which worked, you know, well in the end. But yeah, it was also a struggle.
I mean, what was that like being a foreign student in an environment which I can only imagine is incredibly, I guess, an environment that privileges the verbal? I mean, a lot of architecture schools, I'm sure there's less of an emphasis on the rhetoric around a project. But again, at the AA especially, this conceptual drive and this interest in almost the way that language itself becomes a kind of ornament of a project, I can imagine that must have been a real challenge. And like, how did you come to terms with that, or how did you find your way as someone who speaks English as a second language?
I was always, I think, good at art from really small child, and drawing and make models. So that was the only way I can communicate. You know, I just make drawing and make models, objects, with very few words. So, of course, that's quite limited means to communicate, but still I have something to communicate. And that's why, it was a very tough time at the AA, but still somehow managed to survive through.
Mm. And then following your time at the AA, you worked for David Chipperfield, and then briefly for Haworth Tompkins, and then maybe most significantly for 6A, where you stayed for 11 years. I'm most interested to understand what happened to you having moved through an office like 6A.
When I joined 6A, that was probably the smallest practice I joined. There was five of us when I started. Also the youngest practice, I guess, in terms of how much they established. Again, another liberation in some way that how Tom and Steph operates at the at 6A was about designing the architecture is not the concept. Again, this kind of coming back to this idea of a anti-concept almost. So the, you know, conversation was all about how you put things together and how you make things to happen. So those are the two drive that, you know, really Tom and Steph were pushing. And no nonsense, no bullshit, basically. Just discussing how how things put together. So it was quite good, I thought. It was cleared all somehow a lot of my mind as well.
Focusing more on this anti-concept approach to architecture, which is interested primarily in how things are put together, as you say. Your first, I think it was your first independent project, was a collaboration with the Japanese architect Terunobu Fujimori to build a tea house at the Barbican Center in London for the Japanese House exhibition that was held in 2017. And I read in another interview that you described two different schools of architecture the exhibition set out to portray, and these were the white and the red schools. And they align with the two one-to-one scale models that were installed in the Barbican itself. So Fujimori was one of them, his tea house, which you built. And then I think it was Ryo Nishizawa's Murayama House as well. So in a way, these exemplify two different poles in Japanese architecture. So can you talk more about these different poles or these different schools and where you situate your own practice in relation to them?
Yes. I don't think the Barbican or curator has said this is actually representing red and white. This red and white is, again, Fujimori's idea. He coined this term in, I think, 1980s, you can describe Japanese architects in two types, red group or white group, or white school or red school. So the white represents the brain, and if you open up the head, the brain is white, and which is also the abstraction and the concept. So it's about sort of the head, you know, in your head, sort of thing. And whereas
the cerebral,
whereas the red represents blood. It's about gut. It's about body. So it's about feeling. And there are many shades of pink in between. So that's the kind of a spectrum. And it's quite interesting that, you know, you put it in that way. You think, you know, so where am I belongs to? So
I mean, it probably goes without saying you probably stand more with the red school.
Oh, definitely. Yes. Yeah.
I think it'd be interesting to learn a little more about Fujimori as an architect. I'm not sure how familiar listeners would be with his work. But as you say, he's very idiosyncratic and fantastical as well. Looking at his work and preparing for the interview, I felt like I was dreaming most of the time. I felt like I was in some kind of almost cartoon reality. And the reason I say that is because there are often very few straight lines. The projects often seem to defy gravity. And they seem to engage with the world almost from the perspective that a child would engage with the world in the best possible way. I mean, could you tell me a little more about your relationship with Fujimori, as well as other architects like him working in Japan that might not be familiar to an audience in the UK or elsewhere?
I knew his work before he started doing his architectural design. I mean, he started like age of 40. He's actually an architectural historian who wrote many, many books. He still writes. That's his main job. You know, designing architecture is a hobby in some way. I was and I am still big fan of his writing, and I read most of his books. When he came to the UK, he installed this tea house in V&A. I think it was also 2010. I went to see his talk event with Richard Wentworth, this British artist. It was a good combination, actually. They had a kind of common interest in terms of street observations and stuff. After the lecture, I went up to the stage and show him Raven Law picture. I made this building here in UK, used the char timber, stuff like that. Would you like to come have a look? He said, yeah, so let's meet tomorrow. I'll come to see your building. I was quite shocked, you know, so spontaneous and so casual, and you know, and clearly he's interested. So I took him and showed him around, he blasted, you know, laugh when he saw this char timber cast into cast iron. You know, he said, "I never seen anything like this before." So I was like, "Oh yes," I made him say that. So since then, kind of in touch, and when I started teaching program at the Kingston, I always wanted to do this Red School research. So visiting Red School architects in Japan and meet them and see their building work with students. So including Fujimori. Fujimori is, he himself described dark red almost sort of black. So he's one of them. His best friend, Osamu Ishiyama, is another contemporary architect to the same sort of age as Fujimori. Is quite eccentric building, quite well known in Japan. He's a sort of, I guess, the same generation as Toyo Ito and other. And then also trace back to a little bit earlier 1960s work, this Yoshizaka, Takamasa Yoshizaka. He worked for Le Corbusier, and he came back to Japan, and he is a sort of, I guess, godfather of Japanese Corbusier school. He's not around, but I saw his colleague, Yuko Saito. She took us around to show us this seminar house building in Hachioji, in the suburb of Tokyo. And then this...
And just as a note to listeners, I'll have a list of these names in the show notes for anyone who's interested in learning more. But sorry, yeah. To interrupt, please continue.
Yes. And then this guy called Keisuke Oka, he's... contemporary young guy who is building this concrete house in middle of Tokyo by himself for more than 10 years. He's called Mitano Gaudi. It's like, he's a quite eccentric guy too. He was also part of this Japanese house exhibition. He came over to London actually for the opening. So what was the question? Sorry, I've lost that throat now.
I mean, the question, I think you answered it. It's in part just... situating people like Fujimori amongst other architects who are part of this so-called Red School. And I think there's an increasing attraction to this way of making architecture. In a talk you gave recently, I think it was for the 100 Day Studio, this was back in 2020 actually, a lecture series that the Architecture Foundation put on, you gave a talk called From the Ground. And in part, you were describing this definition of nature that was against science and an interest for you in the accidental and the coincidental. And I think most importantly, the immeasurable. And you talked about your interest in surrealism and that which occurs beyond the conscious mind. And I feel like all of these things for me are really embodied in this kind of Red School approach to architecture, where we can start to think about nature in a way that is quite surreal. And at the same time, we're understanding and learning more about craft and technique and the kind of pragmatics of construction. I guess, first of all, I want to ask, would you agree with that assessment? Because there's more I want to ask along those lines, if so.
So these architects, perhaps including myself, I'm not sure. Yeah, the craft is a kind of a funny word. Actually, Tom Emerson consciously avoided using that word because it's so loaded. Fujimori hates craft, actually. He almost sort of anti-craft. Deliberately, it's quite mischievous actually. So quite kind of provoking as well in terms of work with craftspeople. Ishiyama as well. I mean, he puts things unthinkable, unimaginable, not the sort of craftspeople would do, things like putting the traditional plaster onto the web of the steel beams and stuff. It's quite bonkers. There's a lot to do with the DIY and this idea of a bricolage, I guess, was quite strong at 6A while I was there. You know, any sculptor were around, and you know, we were developing this idea of a bricolage as a means to conceive architecture, and then this. Postman Cheval in southern France, who built this ideal palace using the...
Sorry, who is this?
This Cheval? I don't know how to pronounce it properly.
Oh, okay. So listeners can't see what I'm looking at, but it's a highly ornate...
Yes.
It looks like an above ground grotto.
Yeah, this is his dream, basically. He constructed this construction using his memories and also the images he saw on the postcard he was delivering. It all made out of pebbles, the round stones, and also the cement, I guess, or lime mortar built from ground. And this was quite influential piece of architecture that the French surrealist referred to.
Oh, wow.
So this is kind of early stage before the surrealism was coined. It's kind of a savageness or madness. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's something that, you know, he had an urge to build this for mm-hmm. his life, you know, kind of over 30 years or so to complete.
I'm reading here, this is just a Wikipedia article, but it's part of a genre or type or style of architecture that's been referred to as naive art architecture. And maybe it's that childlike quality that we're discussing in these other Red School architects you mentioned that applies to Cheval's work as well. This insistence on resisting a certain correctness or properness or conformity when it comes to the culture of construction and the culture of architecture.
Yes.
So thanks for clarifying that. That's really helpful, actually, to understand that, first of all, craft is a dangerous word. Or not dangerous, but can be easily misrepresented or misunderstood.
Yeah.
And it's actually about, in a way, this naive approach to construction that is about making do, I guess, to some degree with what you have. You mentioned Richard Wentworth, and it's interesting that you actually met Fujimori at a Richard Wentworth talk, that there is this kind of consensus or affinity between, first of all, Wentworth's photography and art, which is observational and delights in the ways in which these strange juxtapositions of materials or these strange constructions appear in everyday environments. And the fact that Fujimori was there, and his work is, of course, as well, I guess now, as you've described it, about finding his own way in construction or creating his own form of craft based on what's available and based on his own imagination.
Yeah, so Fujimori belongs to this group called Street Observation, Rojo, which was led by artist Genpei Akasegawa, who has unfortunately passed away. But still, he was the driver of the group. And Genpei Akasegawa's work is very similar to Richard Wentworth's work. He does this photographic work with some words with it. So it's kind of almost describing as a poetry in some way together.
Mm. Mm.
And one of the work that he described is he feels the God is on the street because you feel something there that but you can't really catch, and then you somehow capture some kind of glimpse of it through the photograph, but it always slips away. He's talking about coincidence, I think, you know, the thing that you can only capture on that moment and it disappears. I don't know. So that is, I found really interesting. I think what Fujimori is doing, my understanding was through the work I've done with him in the Barbican, that the witnessed that we were putting this charcoal interior, we were gluing these bits of charcoal from barbecue bag onto this plastered room as a kind of decoration, and told me not to think. And if you start thinking, you started composing, and then that kills the design. Mm-hmm. So he said that you just pick the one that you, from your tray without thinking, and the speed is important. You just do it as quick as you can. And that I found really fascinating, because that what happens is you pick the large piece first and then stick them, because that's how you grab them fast, and then started becoming smaller. So the pattern become the process of how you pick the pieces. And that's not really, you can't design that. You can only design it through the actions.
Mm.
I think he's looking for the opportunities like this. And that's the kind of the work I would like to do, to create that sort of a room or opportunities to happen, that unexpected result.
Mm.
I do respect the craftspeople as well. I mean, I really admire their knowledge and skills. So my ideal world would be that, you know, combine the two. So the superstructures or whatever that built by the high to the highest quality by the craftspeople, and then some areas that can the public or lay people can participate to do some accidental stuff that add to the I don't know, character or charm to the building.
Mm-hmm.
I missed something.
No, I think that was really clear. And I think the question I keep coming back to is how this mode of designing and construction and this degree of chance and variability and this sense, I guess, of fantasy can start to be translated from these prototypical works into a commercial architecture, or whether or not that's even possible.
I think the future is in design and build. I say this because I had a tremendous experience working on the Churchill College building at 6A. That was my last project delivered at 6A. This core one called New Student Accommodation Building in Cambridge. New built, like 3,600 square meters or so, fairly large, nearly sort of £10 million contract sum. Was done by design build contract. But that was like a dream project to me, that we had a workshop every week with a different trade ahead of program. So they had a SDC, the builders from Midland, had a really good contract manager that program all these activities on time. And we designed together with actually the people who are building it. And that was, I thought, you know, why can't every building build like this?
Mm.
You know? And so I don't know. I think, and also, yeah, we introduced this 150-year-old French railway oak as a kind of cladding, which is all battered and dirty, but that was also, you know, not non, you know, NBS standard specification as such, but we managed to do that because of the involvement of builders. I think future is bright in that sense. Mm. I don't know if we can manage that. I know it's a special situation. It's a high profile project and a healthy budget, and also the contractor was really up for the go for the university jobs, so they, you know, was really supportive. So all this setup was correct. But I guess my hope is that, you know, putting the appropriate people in the appropriate place to deliver the most out of them, whether that is the highly crafted builders or lay people doing some cladding, or you just need to, I don't know, you need to know where to put them. I guess. This is probably my role as an architect.
Many of these projects, or many of your projects, could be described as co-design, which is essentially being authored by a broader community, as opposed to you or your practice alone. On the other hand, many of your co-design projects, including your work for Geisler Arts in Coniston and the Blue Market in Bermondsey, can somehow be clearly attributed to your studio. So I want to understand how you control the co-design process to enable meaningful participation without losing your own sensibility or identity as a designer.
I think when we interject certain point, example of this Coniston, that when we resize the structure and then reconfigured, that's probably when we have our influence on, in terms of proportions and dimensions. The architect's role in some way is the giving the dimensions and deciding the proportions. And that's when, it's quite intuitive in some way. I kind of give certain dimensions because I think it's more beautiful. But also coming from the certain experience, for example, the Blue Bermondsey Clock Tower is the same footprint, 3 meter by 3 meter, as the tea house, Fujimori Tea House in the Barbican, the Japanese house exhibition. And I knew the scale of the space and how many people can fit. And so literally use that dimensions apply to that. And then the cladding has to be tall enough away from the ground that you cannot reach that, that any vandalism can happen. So this kind of a judgment from the experience and also the practical, pragmatic requirements. But at the end of the day, the size of the components, dimensions, and the proportions are controlled by us.
You've explained elsewhere that you're interested in symbolism and animism in architecture as human gestures that pay respect to nature. And I want to understand how these ideas manifest in your own work.
That idea came through probably my visit to Japanese buildings, temples and shrines especially. Since I moved to here, I try to go back to my country at least once a year. I mean, it's got disrupted by pandemic now, but every time I go back there, I try to see as many great buildings as possible. I never visited while I was there. And through then, I kind of realized that all this special places. The place is already special. It's just, mountain or amazing trees or rock or river or something that the nature already possess, the special sort of power. And the building were there to actually amplify that. So the building came after where the place has this sort of power already. And the buildings are acting almost like a flame of the nature. So when you're inside, you sort of frame certain views or certain ways that you appreciate more. And this probably root back to the Shintoism, that the Shinto believes that 8 million gods exist in the world, from the mountain to even object. There is also, the god in toilet, and which is very interesting because I remember clearly that when my family had this mountain hut in near Mount Fuji, we went there every summer, vacations, and it's so basic, the mountain that has a septic tank toilets there, and it has a big hole in the floor, and you can't see the bottom, it's so dark, and I'm always scared to go there, especially nighttime. But I always imagine some monsters lurking underneath and under there. That sort of fear and the darkness and something beyond your control that exists in even in sort of a man-made room like a toilet is something that, I don't know, it's quite important. You somehow forgot, especially sort of the modernism movement, especially in Japan, you know, everything lit in, you know, light, fluorescent light, and there's no shadow there. That also go back to maybe teaching of Peter Salter. You know, he was talking about shadow and how important shadow is. That leads to the, I think, somehow respect to the nature itself. That's another thing to mention is Japan is lots of natural disasters that beyond your control. I mean, ground shakes, so, you know, the earthquake and when that happens, you just, you feel so powerless. You just have to rely on what happens next. You respect, I think, the nature more, especially, I don't know, in this country, UK, there's no earthquake, no major natural disasters. People tend to become, I think, arrogant that you can control everything, but it's not that. So animism and symbolism, this is something I'm very interested in, that especially as a metaphor of nature that people pay respect to, that should really come back more, especially this 21st century, which is you know, the age of environmental crisis.
I'm really drawn to this, I guess, the potential utility of symbolism to start to reorient people's attention or awareness. And I think seemingly because everything needs to have some kind of utility when it comes to to architecture today, there's this real emphasis on building performance. And we talk about environmentalism and sustainability, but ornament can have a function. And as we've learned from people like Farshid Mousavi, there's a function of ornament and there's a utility to ornament that I think you're getting at when you talk about the importance of symbolism in buildings and the importance of animism, which is a different idea altogether, but is essentially understanding the inherent kind of beingness or living quality of seemingly inanimate objects. And I think to that point, I really experience that when I see images of projects like the one in Milton Keynes, the Modernist Glade project, or even the Made in Bermondsey project. In both cases, there are raised foundations for these pavilion structures that consist of large stone boulders. And then a light timber frame balances on top of them. And in such a simple gesture of raising the wood above the ground and away from the water, but on top of these bizarre and in some ways unfamiliar objects. You don't expect to see boulders in the city. They're out of place. And maybe this gets at this point about craft that you made, that this is a kind of anti-craft. But I feel like in that detail especially, I experience a sense of animism and I encounter natural objects or natural materials in a way that is quite jarring and brings me out of this complicitness or this false sense of comfort and the fact that in some ways we are in control or that we can control nature. And I think it's in those kinds of details that I get most excited about the potential of symbolism and the potential of animism, as you've described it.
I think that's come down to the earlier conversation about my interest in jellyfish and stuff like this, is that the nature has the forms that you wouldn't expect to see. I think, thinking back at the time at Musabi, the Musashino University in Tokyo, what I was trying to do was, can I create architecture like jellyfish or inside of a tree? I didn't know how. I'm still searching for it. The ways to appreciate and express using these natural materials is one way.
I guess for me, there's just a real sense of excitement around this continued search. and again, how it will continue to manifest in different ways at different scales. Takeshi, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, no, thank you.
You've been listening to Scaffold. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I produce the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Luke Blair. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. If you like the show, spread the word and leave a rating on iTunes while you're at it. Thanks to Takeshi Hayatsu, thanks as always to Scandalin, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next week.